Welcome to That Makes Total Sense, a podcast dedicated to exploring God's generosity and justice. I'm Alexis Busetti, a Christian aiming to ask good questions and encouraging you to do the same. Every one of us is wired by God to live out generosity and justice, but the how sometimes eludes us. That Makes Total Sense is a way for us to get together, posture ourselves as learners, and challenge one another to practice generosity and justice in a tangible way every day. So I am super pumped. Jennifer, I just want to say first, before we even get going, that the cover of this book is incredibly beautiful.
It is, isn't it? I feel so lucky. You know, I don't know if people know that authors don't actually have much say in the cover. It's all a lot of marketing people and design people. And so when it got sent to me, you know, my editor gave me the, oh, you know, you don't have any say, but we would take input. And my only input was, I love it. Oh, it's so amazing. It's so beautiful. And this man, the man who designed it, David Fassett, is just incredibly talented. I actually Googled him and saw that he has really very beautiful covers. So I feel, and it's weird, but I'm not a very visual person. I'm a much more of a word person, unsurprisingly, but it really does kind of capture what the book's about. All of the swirly and the sort of all the ways that the story goes, but also there's a lovely plant on the back that then is the beginning of every chapter. And I love that idea of the organic and the, anyway, it's so striking. So I feel just very blessed to have been gifted such a beautiful cover to send the book into the world.
It's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. So if you haven't figured it out yet, I'm with Jennifer Holberg, professor, author of this incredible work called Nourishing Narratives, The Power of Story to Shape Our Faith. And I will tell you that I usually check out the endorsements, as I think most do. This is why they exist, right? And Notorious KSP, Karen Swallow Pryor, was on the podcast not long ago. And I will tell you, we can thank Karen. Thank you, Karen. I got my jitters out talking with her. my English professor jitters are pretty much gone after talking with her. I told her I was super nervous. I haven't read. Working on my second graduate degree right now, but still, I haven't read a lot of the classic, you know, books we ought to have read if we are learned, is kind of how I've joked for the last, I don't know, couple of centuries that I have, a couple of decades. I mean, that I haven't read these books. I'm not that old. Couple of decades. And so there was a little bit of intimidation still going into this book because I thought, I don't know, an English professor, is she going to reference stuff I have no idea about? The short answer, yes. The longer answer, it didn't matter.
Right.
So I just kind of want to throw that out there. I'm interviewing an English professor. If there are other folks like me who are like, I don't know, I don't remember on this or that, or I couldn't name this author, it's okay. This is a beautiful.
It's so okay.
It's so okay, right?
And there's just so many books that I haven't read either. I have a PhD in English.
Time.
Right. I mean, I think the secret of people who have a PhD in English is we know a lot about three or four books. And then we've taught for a million years. So last week I was I met with a group about the book and someone said, oh, did you have a spreadsheet with all the poems that are in the book? Because I reference a lot of poems, partly because they're easy, short text to talk about. But also, I think people feel more intimidated about poetry than they should. I was just saying to a student last week, you know, you like songs. You can talk to me about Taylor Swift in depth. And that's really just a poem set to music, right? So we have lots of ways in which I think people shame other people about either their lack of what they haven't read, or people feel like there was kind of a secret decoder ring that they never received. And so they get really put off by literature in ways that I think is unfortunate. And sometimes I think the field has done that, right? Oh, well, you haven't read blah, blah, blah. But I think instead, and in fact, one of the reasons I wrote the book is I'm not actually someone, there are books in this space that say, read this to become that, right? Read Shakespeare for 30 days and become a better person. Maybe. But I'm really actually more interested in all the stories that we're telling. I mean, if you have a particular sort of theological point of view, but then you love The Bachelor, like, what does that tell you about the real stories? Or you love a Hallmark Christmas movie, or Marvel Universe is your thing. All of those stories, I think, are really interesting because they're telling us what our real theology is. They're telling us what our narrative expectations are. So even if you've never read Moby Dick, I do think you can be a good person. I say that because I've never read Moby Dick. Karen got in trouble because of talking about, you know, they started talking about Pilgrim's Progress, and the guy who was interviewing her said he didn't really love it. And she said, well, you know, I don't necessarily love it either, but it's good. And that was, of course, the internet went crazy. But I think that that's really missing the point. We really need to think about our interpretive, like, frames and the way stories help us or don't help us. But the world is big, and there are so many amazing books that come out every year that there's no way to keep up. So no one should feel any shame about what they have or haven't read. I think what we have to think about is how we read, what we read, and what stories are shaping us. And shaping in the title is really meant to be a neutral word, because I think it can shape positively, and I also think it can shape negatively. It can deform us if we have stories that we get trapped in that don't allow us to live into the story of the gospel.
Yeah, thanks for that, Jennifer. I'm really appreciative. I also want to add, it isn't, if you haven't read some of the works you reference, I'm glad you said that about poetry, because I'm one of those people who's intimidated by it highly. I enjoyed the poetry in the book. Two, it doesn't feel like reading, like, it doesn't feel like sitting in on a book club for something you haven't read. And also, you share so many of your own stories and stories involving your community and people around you, your parents, your family. And that was really refreshing and wonderful. You already talked about it a bit, but I'm wondering if you could, right now I'm thinking of the introduction and also, of course, threads that went throughout the book, but I'm wondering if you could illuminate a little bit some of the specific things that you wanted to accomplish in this work regarding narrative. I say that because story, narrative, even those terms are like doing a lot of heavy lifting right now. And they're kind of, I think, at least in kind of circles that I run with, there's a lot of throwing this around, especially, you know, we think about like banned books, you know, I'm living in Texas, and this is like kind of hot right now in some of these spaces. You know, we talk about, I think about Bryan Stevenson, you know, talking about the lack of informed narrative that we have about our history and how harmful that is as a nation. So anyway, even back to things like, you know, several years ago, Dennis Miller wrote a story brand, right? So this is even like a marketing kind of thing. Like, where do you fit inside of some of the, not Dennis Miller, what is this? Donald Miller. And anyway, not the comedian. Anyway, but you know, where do you fit inside of other people's stories as a way to market, you know, products and things like that. So I think these terms do a lot of heavy lifting, but from an English professor and this perspective of shaping, can you just kind of help us understand like what your goal was, maybe even as a teacher, if people are going to read this book, these are some of the things I want them to come away with.
Right. Thank you. Donald Miller, the blue like jazz guy, right?
Yeah.
Anyway,
great stories in that book, by the way.
There's a couple of things. I mean, one of the things that you talked about was that I use kind of a variety of narratives, including my own. And it's not really a memoir, though. What I'm really trying to do is start to say that you need to be thinking about your own story. And so I hope by sharing some examples from mine that you'll feel ways to share from yours, and then to think about the way that works out in other stories I've gathered, literature, that kind of thing. So that's kind of the mode of the book. I would say a couple of things, because as you say, this is very much a lot of us are, there's a lot of conversation in this space. I mean, you were mentioning, you know, our friend KSP, right? So she's also thinking about the evangelical imagination and the ways in which it has roots in the 19th century. And there's other lots of, like a lot of people are talking about this. So for me, really, it's, my book is really written for, first of all, a popular audience. It's really not written for English professors, and that's important to me. One of my side gigs is that I help run the Festival of Faith and Writing. And that's something that we've at the festival been trying to do since 1990, right, is to bring lots of different kinds of stories together. And I think that's part of it, too. I mean, one of the problems, I think, with banned books is this reduction of the available stories, and also a kind of fear of, well, if I were to read something that I disagree with, somehow it will captivate me or something. And I actually believe in a God that's bigger than any book. And so part of the book is the beginning of the book. The first chapter really talks about, I think, some of the problems we have in Christianity around our own stories. So I talk a little bit about how I talk to a lot of students who don't really think they have a story, that their testimony either isn't exciting enough. It didn't go big enough from dark to light, right? We have the kind of terrible sinner to, you know, works with puppies in the ghetto kind of thing, right? And that's not to say there aren't those stories that are that are quite legitimate and very important. We also have the kind of the super Christian, you know, the person who against all odds has gone and done the thing. And but what about the other stories that don't seem to come about? So like I said earlier, there are some books that are really about what you should read. I don't really care that much about that. I mean, I want people to read things that are in fact nourishing to them. But the fact is that all around us there, we're surrounded by stories from the time we're little kids. And they're really the way that we process. So if you don't think you have a story, if in your church, you're not hearing that you have a story, if you're only hearing those two extremes and nothing in the middle, you're starting to develop, as I talk about in the first chapter, I think you have, I think it leads to really some really bad theology. So for example, if I don't really have a story, or if God didn't really save me from anything, like my sin isn't like as bad as the murdering crack dealer or whatever, who then, you know, has come all this way, then God really isn't at work in my life. You know, I sort of believe I have sins, but not. So all of a sudden, what we think about story really shapes all sorts of things that we have. And then I think we have all kinds of family stories, right? You're the pretty one. You're the smart one. You're the blah, blah, blah. Or you get that at school, or you get that from whatever cultural things that you're comparing yourself to. You get it from Instagram. You get it from. And so part of the book is really, giving a whole series of, if we told this story about God, how would it change the way we think about ourselves? So that's kind of the opening half of the book. They're sort of case studies, not in a very social science-y way, but in a literature professor way. So if we thought about God as faithful, if we told that story, how would that change the story of God's faithfulness to us? If we talked about God as plentiful and bounteous, how would that change our own sense of enoughness? So it's really sort of those kinds of studies. And then the last part of the book is, if we tell better stories, if we can think about things in a better interpretive frame, how would that change the way we can deal with hard things? How do we, in a world where we need to acknowledge brokenness, Bryan Stevenson, when you're talking about racism, all of the bad things, how do we still have a story of hope as Christians without being completely deluded? So I think there's a little poem in the book. It's by a British writer named Stevie Smith, I think dies in about the 80s. Anyway, she wrote this really interesting poem called Waving Not Drowning. And I think it's a really good, what I'm trying to talk about in terms of interpretation, which is the guy in the poem is drowning. But he's always been this guy that joked around and basically buried whatever was going on with himself by what she calls larking, right? Sort of messing around. But when he goes at the end and he's out in the ocean and he's waving his hands to call out for help, everyone interprets that as drowning, as waving. And so part of the point I make in the book is, how do we see the drowning person? And in the first chapter, I also talk, now it's just occurring to me, I have drowning people all in the book. I didn't realize that until just this minute. But in the beginning, I talk about the painting by Bruegel, The Fall of Icarus, and how W.H. Auden writes this poem also that talks about how no one turns their head when the guy drowns. And so, and he says, for them, it was not an important failure. And so what I start every one of my classes with is we look at that and I say, the reason we read literature is for you to A, notice that the guy's falling, because that's important to notice, to turn your head, but also not to just notice, to go further and to make it an important failure for you. And so I always say to my students, you're taking a literature class, especially my gen ed students, right? You're taking a literature class to learn to save the drowning boy. And I think later when I talk about Stevie Smith, same thing. When the man is waving, they're all like, ha ha, he's so funny out there. He's waving, but they aren't interpreting it correctly. And he drowns, right? And so there's all kinds of people around us metaphorically drowning. And sometimes a little or a lot, right? It may be just a season of overwhelmingness but we're just, there's so much. You know, I had a friend from the South who used to talk about being covered up. And I feel like people are covered up all the time. But how do we see that? And then how do we, you know, within our communities, within our faith, you know, traditions, how do we interpret that correctly? Not as larking, not as whatever, not as I'm too busy. But so part of what I'm really trying to get at is not what you read, but how you read and how we pay attention, but then also save the drowning boy or save the drowning man in that poem.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. We talked about before you and I started recording, you know, kind of where do we want to go today and blah, blah, blah. We don't have a list of questions from the publicist or from me, right, or from you. But you know, and both of us, you know, just so everyone knows, we both said, I don't really care. Let's go somewhere. But as I was jotting down my notes and as you were talking, I thought, oh dear. So here's what I did. There were aspects of my current story that I'm exploring, and what I wrote down really kind of hit these, you know, maybe data points, right? I'm married to a scientist, so sometimes I use phrases that I don't really fully, you know, I don't mean to fully use it that way, but, you know, I have these kind of touch points maybe,
I know they're not case studies, but yeah.
Right. So these case studies, these touch points, these data points, but, and so I find that really interesting. So I would like to explore some of those a little bit more but also with the understanding that, just as you mentioned, when we notice, we're noticing things about our own stories. We're noticing things about one another's stories. And you put these in this book and we don't know each other. And so you didn't think, well, goodness, Alexis is really contemplating what, you know, the meaning of this. And so but this means, and there's particularity and there's universality too.
Right.
And so I think that some of this is captured here.
As you were asking me earlier, I mean, one of the reasons that I wanted to have some of my own stories in there, I mean, I didn't, someone said, oh, did you ever think about writing a memoir? And I thought, no. But I do think we need to, the Christian model is testimony, right? It is constantly like listening to other people's stories. And the whole Bible is just a series of people's stories that we get to listen into and learn from what God did in their life. And so I really think, and I also as a teacher believe this, I don't think it's fair if the teacher only ever asks the students to share and they never share back. I think there has to be a professional level of vulnerability in the same way I don't expect students to share everything. But I do think that we need to share, because I do think we have a lot of things in common. I was telling you about being at a mom's time out, which was a wonderful event, really enjoyed chatting with those women, even though I'm not a mom, I'm a single childless spinster. But it was awesome because we had a lot in common in terms of faith struggles. And the fact is, so one of the chapters is about sort of feeling not enough. And I just think that's true all over the place. And so some of what this came from too, is just a long time teaching and talking with people and reading literature and hearing people talk about the things they're struggling with. And I think we have so much more in common than our culture often tells us we do. Oh, you don't have children, so you wouldn't get it. Why would you come to a mom's thing? Or why would they even invite me, right? But of course they did, and because they saw some, and we had a great time. And why would I go? I'm going to speak to a senior citizen thing pretty soon. Well, I mean, I have gray hair, but right. But I just think, and also there's so much we can learn from each other. One of the verses that's become important to me as I've written about it is that verse from Psalms about one generation will testify to the other. And I talk about how when I was younger, I always saw that as a one-way thing, that old people would tell me about God's faithfulness through their long life. And great, like that's important and respectful and all of that. But the longer I teach, in fact, the whole kind of last chapter is about kind of my annoyance, I guess would be the kindest word, with the kind of kids these days, or constantly defaulting to what's wrong with the generation, rather than trying to understand that perspective and how each of us then could hear that and receive that and maybe learn some things about what God's doing in that generation and how that can give me a bigger and bigger picture. So I'm sorry, I kind of derailed your question there. So we can go back to what
No, no, that's all right. I will comment on the derailment. It actually was one of the notes I had about this idea of being lifelong learners and this mutual kind of learning relationship to it, to a degree that you talked about. And I'm in seminary, and I served for a couple of years on the student council, and the seminary was hiring quite a few professors at one time. And so I was able, because of my position on the council, to be in some of those interviews. And I am, 40 something, and I also have gray hair, and this is my, second graduate degree, the one that I never thought I would go back in and get. But different from doing my undergraduate or my first master's when I was in my 20s, one of the things that I realize and I love about the seminary environment, especially at least where I study, is that so many of us are not 25. There's nothing wrong with being 25 in seminary. Yeah. It's beautiful. And I love learning from the 25-year-olds in seminary. But there are also lots of folks who have, maybe that many years of ministerial experience under their belt. And, what can we learn from them? And so the question that I always asked, my default when I was interviewing a candidate, was something to the effect of, tell me about a time when you have learned from your students. And it only happened a couple of times that the candidate couldn't give me an answer. And that feedback on my form for those interviews looked very different than the ones where, they're kind of combing through and thinking, gosh, the response is often, I learn from my students every day. Let me try and, think of something like that. But that kind of posture of learning is something that I think, even when we're in positions like you are and describe yourself, we just all of us, it would do us good to stay in that posture.
Yeah, and I think that it just gives you such a much better learning community too. It's not a very interesting class if you just write down what I say, right? It just isn't. I don't really want to read that. As a test. And I think the other thing is really, again, what is the aim of why you're taking? So one of the things I spend a lot of time, and I do it more every year, is just making clear to students why I'm asking them to do the things I'm asking them to do, what I'm hoping that they're going to leave with, what's the portable skill or the habit of heart and mind, because I really am quite convinced that most education is not really about the transmittal of knowledge, although that's important, but that it's about dispositions. It's about, especially in a literature class, I think it's really about, are you a better interpreter when you leave than when you came in? Now, you may or may not remember all the specifics of the life of Charlotte Bronte or the dates of Queen Victoria's reign. I hope you have some context and that was good. But I think more than that, it's about why can you look at a story, at a text, and sort of think critically of it, take what you from all of those things, in the same way that I say, you know, we do this, as this shouldn't surprise us as Christians. Literally, we spend our entire lives going at least once a week, and a lot of us go to an extra Bible study, and all we do is we look at a text again and again and again and again. And we expect that even though I've heard Philippians 1 preached on 72 other times, that this person this morning is also going to have something to share with me. Like, we actually think the Bible is big enough and capacious enough that we can spend a lifetime and never feel like we totally mind its steps, right? I love in Augustine, in On Christian Teaching, Augustine talks about the fact that the Holy Spirit so intended the Bible that every reader was anticipated. And I think that's really cool, right? I mean, that is a living, breathing document. That's a thing that says you're always still welcome. There's more to be said. I talk in the book about how I think one of the most important parts of God's character is that God is the God of leftovers. You know, if you think about the feeding of the 5,000, you know, the efficient way to do that would Jesus have been to be like, do, 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 well, there's how many people and we will make exactly this much. And you could have had this lovely sentence in the Gospels that said, and everyone ate their fill. Wouldn't that be lovely? Like, you could preach a whole sermon on everyone ate their fill. But what we get is everyone ate their fill and never leftovers, right? There's always more than enough. And, you know, when you were talking about book banning just seems to me to be about the pie is too small. It's not a God of leftovers kind of thing. It says, this thing is so dangerous and my God is so small that I couldn't possibly read something that I disagreed with, because I'm so weak that I could, you know, that I'll be shifted over. And, you know, Flannery O'Connor talks about how it's only the person whose faith is weak that needs like a lot I'm not getting your quote right. It's in the book, but anyway, it's only the person whose faith is really weak that needs to be afraid. And I think it is true that sometimes when our faith is weak, right, we need to compass ourselves around with our community and scripture and all of those things. But, you know, the strong person of faith shouldn't be all that worried. We should be able to look at things and say, hey, how is this affecting me? No, you know, but this is a very persuasive argument. This is a very persuasive story, but here's where it doesn't line up against the stories that I know are true. So anyway.
No, Jennifer, it's so good and it's so rich. And I want to ask you to talk about, again, kind of one of the things that I was reflecting on as I was thinking about my own story, my own journey, but also me as a learner. And that is when you talk about Martha, this chapter
That's my favorite bit.
So. Is it? It felt so, that's good to hear. It felt so refreshing to me. And I feel like I'm one of these people, I've studied Martha from a lot of angles. I've heard a lot of sermons on Martha. I read the book you referenced on Martha probably 15 years ago, 10 or 15 years ago or something like that. I don't know how old the book is, but pretty quickly after it came out. And your take on Martha was refreshing. And I'm going to stop myself there and let you take over because you'll talk about it way better than me. But I just loved this. So go for it.
Well, thank you. That is probably in the book. you know, I make no claims to originality for most of the things in the book. A lot of it is like lots of people are talking about it, and I just have a new take or a sort of, you know, interesting way in. But the Martha thing, I do think, is a contribution that I think that I'm making. But yeah, so I feel like as Martha has been somebody who is a character that gets used to beat up, I think, women of all kinds, though it's often the active women, but it's all kinds of women. And I think I also make this point, I think that Mary also gets completely reread. And so what I try to do in that chapter, which is on vocation, so Calvin, where I teach, is very big on this. We talk a lot with students about, you know, the way in which God is calling you into the world, and that we hope for them it's going to be more than a sense of their job, right? That people often reduce vocation to job, but we really want them to have a very, you know, big idea of their calling. But I really am convinced, the more that I've studied Martha and I've thought about her and I collect icons of Martha, and she's just such a fascinating character to me, because I think she's so misread. And so what I talk about in the book is that I think that her story is we've misread it because we aren't getting the genre right. And so I make the point that I think that in the same way that we have these stories of the disciples being called away from their first work, thank you for the cheerleading.
I'm pointing at Jennifer, like,
yes,
like, yeah, so, good.
Girl, so good. I'm feeling very encouraged. all the Martha people in the house. Anyway, that in the same way that Peter gets called away from his boat and Matthew gets called away from his tax collecting, that Martha is called away from her kitchen. And that's not to say that that's a bad thing that she's doing. It's not a denigration of women's work. It's just saying that we have a further calling. And the same way that Peter goes back and fishes again, right? And we see Martha in the last scene serving, but it's because she now knows who she really is. And that the other times we see Martha, then she's acting as a disciple. She literally has a conversation with Jesus that is analogous to how someone would speak to their rabbi. And then I go on to make the point that I think Mary too, she's seen as this, like, oh, Martha was the bossy, loud, you know, whatever. And Mary was quiet and sat at the feet of Jesus. Yeah, because she had already, like, heard the call out of the kitchen. Like, she actually is in some ways more radical in terms of the way she's already claimed her discipleship. You know, already at some point before the story begins that we see, Jesus has also said to her, like, hey, you can come listen to me. And she's claimed that. And Martha's still clinging on to, like, the way it's supposed to be. And Jesus is like, your narrative expectation is really messed up. The story you're expecting, the thing you think should happen, the way the story should go, is not the story I have for you. And I think the Christian faith is really, I have a surprising story for you. It's not the way you think it's going to be, right? I have so much more, and I want so much more for you, and I want you to join me. So that whole chapter is really about kind of rethinking vocation through my favorite Bible character, Martha, to think about the way in which Jesus is really calling all of us to discipleship. And I thank you so much, because that is probably, if I do have a favorite part of the book, that's probably it, because I love her so much.
Oh, well, I loved her more after I read what you wrote about her. So thank you for sharing that. I just think it's just, yeah, it is. And I'm appreciative of the focus on vocation that you mentioned, in your tradition. That has been something that has influenced me the past several years, especially, but even as I, you know, like I said, kind of in midlife, you know, I'm kind of taking a different turn than what I thought, just being able to kind of have a more holistic view on vocation has been really great.
And I think what midlife does to you is, especially as you, right? I remember when I got tenure, or, you know, people raise their children or they get that promotion or they're doing okay in the world, you start to think, huh, well, is that all there is, right? And that's a narrative, right, where you start to understand the ways in which if you have adopted or bought into the ways about what counts as success, the promotion, the tenure, the whatever it is in your field or in your life, you start to understand that, like, but that's that kind of at some point is like, well, okay, like here I am, I'm 40, whatever, I'm 50, whatever. Like, and so part of what I want to talk about is that ways in which our narrative expectations, what we think is supposed to happen, what we think will fulfill us, all of those things really is not what the Bible teaches us. And there's so many ways, and I say this to students all the time who are quite anxious about, well, am I going to pick something that's important enough? One of the things I love about my Calvin students is they really do want to make a difference in the world, right? They want to do good. They want to do things that are going to have impact and, you know, really, and I really honor that. But I also think that's a high bar. And so much of life is doing the dishes again, driving a kid to a practice. I go to about a million meetings. I am in my office. I'm the department chair now, and people just need to come by and chat with me. And, you know, that is not in any kind of rubric, a successful day. Like, what did you get done? Well, I talked to 16 people about various things that they need, but actually it is, because one of the things I talk about is what we're called. So the rest of that book, the rest of that chapter, one of the other people I talk about is Matthias, who's really kind of stuck out to me, because, you know, here's the guy who gets to be the 13th apostle. You would think that was like a big deal, right? There's only 12 of them. And then, you know, Judas goes away and they pick this guy, and there's this little story about him. And then you literally never hear about him ever again.
Never.
Like, you would think that there would be at least some kind of reference to him in a letter, or he would, but even his apocrypha, like, is all over the map. They're not even sure where he served, how he died. And that's just kind of crazy to me, because you would think in any kind of standard, he would have been like one of the top people. But one of the points I make in the book, and it actually is what I gave the chapter the name, you know, the Bible says he was a witness ready to serve. And I just love that. I find that very convicting, right? A witness ready to serve. And that was it. And that's all we really have to be. And everything else we do is wonderful and lovely, but it's the icing. As long as we're a witness ready to serve, like, our life is already successful. And so I think all the angst we feel about, have I done enough, or what have you done for me lately, or today wasn't that important, it's okay. Like, all God calls us to be is a witness ready to serve and to be present that day and whatever the day's calling is, right? And so I also feel like one of the narrative things that we really suffer from is, when I get here, right? When I finish this degree, when I get married, when I have the child, when I have a grandchild, it's always future oriented in ways that we never then live in the present. And we're never fully available to all the stuff that we already have, which is a lot. Like, in any one day, just all the stuff I am is like more than enough. And are we living fully into that, being present, and serving those little, all those unseen little ways too. So part of what I want to talk about with Martha too is, she's somebody who is doing something kind of unglamorous, and yet she's really important. And Christ calls her out of that kitchen too to come sit at his feet, not because the kitchen isn't important, but because it's not her ultimate calling.
Yeah. I feel called by your book to the kind of messy and the hopeful middle. And I don't mean like a middle ground, like there's like, yeah, just trying to kind of skirt, you know, skate on a certain way or compromise, but in this middle that we've talked about a lot, you know, the testimonies aren't extreme. The dishes have to be washed again. And I want to kind of segue to there's no way we're going to get through all of the notes that I had, which is fantastic. People can read the book and have their own notes about it. But one of the places that really stood out to me, and it's been, I say for several years, I've been trying to get better at parsing out nuance in kind of the messy middles of all of our lives, really. I'm thinking of the George Bush story, just so you're mm-hmm. there before I get there. But a few years ago, I read a book by Sho Baraka, and he talks about gold and shadows. And everyone's lives, there are gold and shadows. And he said the thing that stood out so much to me was when we read the story of David, that as Christians and as people of the of Judeo-Christian faith, we see David as who? A man of after God's own heart. But one of the things he says, not to, you know, shame the legacy of David, but he says, would Uriah's family have thought of him that way?
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Which is valid. And so that's not to say one undoes the other. It's just that we're complex people.
Right.
And you quote this line in the story about Bush that I want to let you get to that really stood out to me. It says, we like our villains without redemption and our heroes without blemish. And we frequently assign those roles in overly strict alignment with our ideology. And
right.
This was following George Sr.'s life. I want you to get there. I will say, kind of on a personal note, one of the things that struck me about this, so, you know, fun trivia fact, I went to Girl State in Oklahoma, actually.
Oh, right.
I don't know that I've ever met anyone outside of my Girl State group who had maybe even heard of Girl State or Boy
yeah.
State.
Yeah.
I did not know there was a Girls Nation. I did not get that far. Fun fact, I kind of, quote, ran for governor half-heartedly in my Girls State. I did not even make the runoff. This girl with a really fun speech did. And she won, and it was great. And I ended up serving as the congressional chaplain, which now, this many years later, I think is hilarious. So
yeah.
anyway, so please talk a little bit about that, the essence yeah. of that story with your interaction with George Sr.
Right. So for those of you who don't know, the American Legion has a long running, I mean, I think it started many, many decades ago, kind of government, mock government program for people in every state. There's a boy state and there's a girl state, and you go for a week and you do all the at the county level and the state level, and you get to run for different offices. And if you're into government kinds of stuff, it's really quite fun. And then they have a program that two people then get elected to go to DC for a week and do on the national level at Girls Nation. I went to high school at least the last 2 years in New Mexico. Yeah, so we had a whole thing where we had to go be interviewed and the whole place voted for you. And it was amazing. It was the first time I'd ever been to Washington, D.C., and you get a full ride trip. But one of the big things, and some people may have seen, I reference this in the book, some people may know about Boys Nation because there's a famous picture of Bill Clinton shaking hands with Kennedy, because one of the things you always get to do is each the boys group and the girls group in there, you go in different weeks. But anyway, you get to go to the Rose Garden and have this ceremony and meet the president and get pictures and all of that. Well, my year, I'm dating myself, but I was Reagan era, and he had surgery the week we went. And so we were the first ever group that did not get to meet the president. And we were very sad about this. And when we went to the White House, they did a very nice extra things for us, but, you know, not the same as getting to meet the president. But then the other thing they do is that they pay for you to go to whatever is on at the Kennedy Center. And so we went to see Loretta Lynn, which at the time we were all a little bit like, what? But it was an incredible show, I will say.
My mom's going to be so jealous, by the way.
Oh, it was so amazing. She was incredible. One of the best live shows I've ever seen. Anyway, we were looking around and I spotted up in the first balcony, Barbara Bush, and because of her hair. And I said to one of my other fellow Girls Nation people, I was like, hey, is that, you know, Barbara Bush? And they said, I don't know, but I think that's George next to her. And I was like, let's go up and see if they'll meet us. And everyone was sort of like, you're crazy. But a bunch of people came up and I went over and I talked to the Secret Service. And you have to understand that they made us in the 80s. We had to wear these dresses. And we had
in the 90s, too. We were still wearing dresses every single day.
We had dresses and we had these little ribbons that said like Girls Nation. And then on the top of it, it said our state. So it was it was like the nerdiest possible girls wearing like as if we were in like some kind of pageant. Not quite that bad. They weren't sashes, but they were ribbons. And we had these little white gloves in the 80s. Anyway, so I go up and I talk to this poor Secret Service agent and give him our sad tale of woe, all of which to say, he's like, well, I'll go ask. And then slowly everyone kept leaving because they were like, he's never going to come out. This was during the intermission. And there were about maybe 8 to 10 of us left. And all of a sudden, the intermission was almost over. And all of a sudden the door opened and all these Secret Service agents kind of lined up and he came out. And he like spent a lot of time with us and said hello. And like every single one of us, he knew something about, he would say like, where are you from? And he had some like person he knew there or thing about our state that he knew, but he was not hurried. He was just, and you know, we were like 16, 17 year old girls. Like we couldn't vote for him. We weren't very important. And he was just so kind. And let us take like pictures. And although, you know, the days before the phone, I had a little instant, like one of those little cardboard. So I have all these weird pictures of like the side of his face. Because we're like, anyway, all of which to say, in the book, what I'm talking about is people have a lot of views about him. You know, they're anger at him about the Gulf War or various things. And I want to say, you know, as we think about him from a historical point of view or something like that, certainly we should think about people in the rounded what their administration did and didn't do. But I also wanted to give it as an example of someone who was in a place of power who did not have to be kind. He did not have to go out of his way. And it just meant a lot to us. And I just think it is another part of his character. And he was genuinely a very nice person. And I just, you know, when he died, I've always thought about that. So that's a really long story, but, it's a thing though, that means something, right? When you're a kind person, you know, it doesn't mean maybe you don't make decisions in terms of policy that I wouldn't have agreed with, or maybe I would have. But how do we tell stories like that? And that quote is from an obituary written about him at the time, trying to capture the same thing. How do we tell stories? And I think for me, it's also important that I think about that for myself too, because so often we start to say, well, I'm the hero of my own story. I'm the, you know, the heroine. And I wonder about that because I think, you know, one of the other things I often talk with students about is, you know, what is the perspective? So you brought up Uriah. I always say, I don't understand why anyone decorates their children's room with Noah's Ark. Because
that was the other bullet point I had, by the way. So right? I'm glad you're bringing it up. Yes.
How is that? Like, how is that a good story? It's only a good story if you're on the boat. Right. And that's I think the problem often in church, in Sunday school in particular, is we're always on the boat. We're never the people that got left behind. We're never the people that drowned. And that's horrific to think about that level of death. I mean, like Noah's Ark is a deeply disturbing story if you really think about it. And I think the Bible calls us to think about it. You know, I think we have these versions of the Bible where it's just all pleasant. Actually, the Bible is just one terrible thing after another. And it's how do we think about the God who is with us despite all of that? I talk in the book a little bit about teaching Sunday school and how we're very committed at my church to like doing all the stories. And I was like, yeah, get it. Yeah. Oh yeah. I'm Miss, you know, complicated narrative, and I'm an English professor and all the things. But actually then I get the story of how the Israelites have to die out before they can, well, how do you talk about that to the first graders? Right. Right. And I can tell I broke up a little bit.
No, it's just that I'm trying to laugh under my breath so that I don't give my husband more editing work. But yes, I mean, yes.
Right.
Stories are complex and hard and devastating. Right.
So when you're talking about banning books, have you read the Bible? And I know that's a commonplace thing that people say, but I do think if we actually understood our own text, we would know that there is a problem there.
Yeah. I'm so grateful. And I think it's really funny that you brought up Noah's Ark, because that literally was the last bullet point I had. So we did make it through ours, just barely by the skin of his teeth. But but I still invite people to grab a copy of the book because it's amazing. But I was feeling just kind of I was feeling a heaviness on Sunday. And I was reminded to, you know, I'm a seminary student. I was reminded to think about ritual. You know, what place does ritual have in our lives? And that as humans, this is something that we, I mean, just kind of innately desire, I think, is to some degree some of these rituals to remind us of things, who we are, who God is, you know, creation, things like this. Anyhow, I am currently in a church tradition that does not take communion every single week, but we did take it on Sunday.
Right.
And as I held the bread, it took me a while to go up. And in our congregation, we take the elements with our own hands, and then we just take it back to our seats, and we have the freedom to take it within a certain, you know, before the song ends kind of thing. And I was holding the bread, and I just, inside of that ritual, I just kind of became a little bit overtaken by the complexity of ourselves as humanity. And you know, I even referenced this story when I was kind of processing and just chatting with my husband over breakfast. And I mentioned the George H.W. portion, and I said how encouraging and hopeful that's been for me in my own story, as you referenced, that we're all complex and we have these golden shadows. And sometimes it's tempting to even label ourselves or other people. I'm a good person. He's a bad person. But that for the vast majority of us, it's much more rich and complex than something, some small little label. And God created us as very good. And so anyhow, I was holding this bread and thinking about Jesus just entering into the complexity of the human story. And didn't have any sort of, and didn't need in that moment, any sort of resolution to that.
Yeah.
It just gave me, just that acknowledgement gave me hope.
Yeah, right. Well,
just that he just entered in with us. It's complex and he came, right?
Exactly. And
into that complexity.
He himself is complex.
That's right.
As a human being, right? I mean, when we always talk about Jesus as fully human, what does that actually mean? And I think it's been interesting when people do adaptations, or, you know, I've read a few things about people who've been watching The Chosen, who've gotten upset about things like him telling jokes or,
the toot noises are my favorite.
Yeah. I mean, and you just think, well, but if you really believe in this incredible paradox of, you know, fully human, fully divine, like he was he himself was complex. Yes. And I think that that's really important. And I think the kind of graciousness that we can extend to other people, it's really hard. And I think it's one of the hardest parts of the Christian faith. It's not necessarily believing in God. It's believing that other people are beloved of God as much as we are, right? I will often, you know, Marilynne Robinson was at the festival, and she said to me something that's always stuck with me, that what she tries to say to herself when she gets annoyed is, how has this image of God offended you?
Wow.
And I'm like, oh dear, like through the heart, right? Like, wow. And so I find myself saying that, like, okay, image of God, image of God, image of God, right? Because if you actually do believe that, and we say we do, then how are you living that out? And how are you thinking about today, like, and all the things about their story you don't know? And how can we extend grace, even as they're also, you know, we don't have a consequence-free grace, right? But there's like, there may be consequences to the, so I often say to my students, if they decide they want to skip or something, I say, well, you know, adult decisions have adult consequences. But, you know, on the other hand, I can't get too, it's sort of like cheating. I say the same thing to them. If you're a kind of person that cheats, that's not really about me. Like, if you get one over on me, okay, congratulations, you got an A you didn't deserve. But that's not about me. That's, I trusted you. I thought that you were not a person that cheats, and you took advantage of me. So that's really about your character and the kind of person you're willing to be and the person you're going to become. But I can't get, you know, there are teachers who turn into Jean Valjean, you know, and they're going to chase you down through every sewer of Paris to like check your plagiarism. If I didn't catch it, well, go your way, but also you still know. But how do we extend grace? And that's really hard. And I think with the people we're closest to, often the hardest, because we, you know, rub up against all of those frictions all the time, you know? And so I just think part of that is saying image of God, also complexity of story. It's why I think people have been drawn to the Enneagram, right? Is because that's about kind of you at your best, but also all of the kind of, as they talk about, you mentioned it earlier, the shadow sides, right? But I think there's all these ways to continue to say to ourselves, I have a story about myself that can actually be quite trapping, that can really hold me back, because I've decided these certain things are true about myself. And sometimes they need to, you know, sanctification is a long process. And we need to sort of introduce new stories about ourselves or not get trapped, but also hold to the ones that are really true, like you are beloved. And I really see in my students and, you know, people I know, just how often they don't understand how lovely and beloved they are. It's usually not that people are having overinflated. I certainly know a few of those, but usually it's that they're, oh, I don't know. And I just think if you could understand how much God, if we could live into that, that would be incredible, right? The magnitude of God's love for us should overwhelm us. And what are stories that help us get to that? So even the Martha story that we talked about earlier, you know, when it, you know, I've heard different sermons where people sort of talk about Jesus rebuking her. And I'm like, you know, I really hear that as much more of a friendship, you know, the hard thing your friend needs to say to you, like, hey, girl, maybe you should chill a little bit, but like from out of love. I mean, I really feel like Jesus is friends with her, and he's speaking to her as a friend would, which is a hard thing, but also a true thing and a loving thing. So Martha always comes back, right?
That's right. Thank you, Jennifer, so much for talking about your book, for helping us notice, helping me notice some of these stories. I really am so, so incredibly grateful. And we hit all the bullet points. I just can't even believe it. We did. I feel like, not that that would have been success or not success.
No, great conversation. We're okay. Right. Success is okay. You know, that's part of it. We want to do things well and unto the Lord. And it's just, I'm really grateful for you as a reader and a really good and thoughtful reader. That is, as someone, when you write a book, you just don't know. I mean, I sat at this little computer and So it's fun to get to meet people and to get to talk more and get to have my world widen today by getting to know you. So my thanks to you.
Well, I'm so appreciative. The book, again, is called Nourishing Narratives, The Power of Story to Shape Our Faith. It's out now by IBP, and I will list it along with a handful of other things that we chatted about in the show notes. So there'll be a link to where people can find this. Thank you so much again, Jennifer.
Yeah, God bless you.
The links for all the resources mentioned in today's episode can be found in the show notes. Music and podcast production by Seth Busetti. Be sure to give us a review on iTunes and subscribe at your favorite podcast listening app. You can also visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com.